Support for WPR comes from All Energy Solar, committed to offering battery backup solutions for solar systems night and day. More information about battery backup is available at allenergysolar.com.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show today by talking with you about advanced care planning. And we have two guests for you. One, Dr. Lee Vogel, is Executive Director of Mosaic Family Health and an Associate Professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Lee Vogel, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Great to have you with us. And Ben Adams, our other guest, is an emeritus director of the board of directors of the Wisconsin chapter of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. And Ben, thank you for joining us as well.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for having both of us.
They are both founding members of the Fox Valley Advanced Care Planning Partnership as well. I wanted to mention that. And as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. Tell us why and maybe how you decided to complete an advanced care directive. Or maybe you're wondering how to get started with an advanced care plan. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Ben, let's start with you. What is advanced care planning, and why is it legally necessary?
Thanks, Larry. Advanced care planning is critical for all adults in Wisconsin for the reason that under Wisconsin law, as a married person, for example, I can't make my wife's medical decisions if she became incapacitated without going through a court-related guardianship proceeding to become her guardian. Unless she has completed an advance directive before something happens and named me or someone as her agent. And not only that, but we can't make decisions for our adult children if something happens to them, unless they have also completed an advance directive naming a healthcare agent for themselves.
So legally, really a necessity. Dr. Vogel, what about from a medical standpoint?
Well, as a physician, it certainly is important that I know what any patient's decision would be regarding their end-of-life care and how far to extend the kinds of aggressive resources that we can have that use that are not only necessary in some cases but beneficial so that we are following somebody's plan and directive, which should be formed out of their values, their beliefs, their knowledge about their body, perhaps their religious beliefs. And if we don't know that, then we are either guessing and or relying on family that doesn't feel as empowered as if there was a clear directive. And also we run the risk of applying too much, because in our society, the default is that you preserve life. Sometimes life at any cost is unacceptable to some people, but we don't know it.
Yeah. Ben, I know Governor Evers proclaimed this week as Healthcare Decisions Week. Why is it important for us to recognize advanced care planning for a week and not a day?
Well, originally this started out, if you remember, Larry, reading about Benjamin Franklin, who famously said the only two certain things in life are death and taxes. That's the moniker that they used when they created April 16th as Healthcare Decision Day. It's designed to remember people or remind us once a year to not only file our taxes, but consider making arrangements so that we not only choose an agent and authorize them to be a decision maker, but also appoint them to be have legal authority and then file that document with our healthcare providers so that folks like Lee Vogel will know they have somebody who can speak for us.
Yeah. And Dr. Vogel, what have you noticed about the popularity of advanced care directives over time? Has it become more popular?
Yeah, I think, talking about your own death is probably never really popular unless you're in my house and we have strange conversations at holiday times when I bring it up to remind my kids exactly what I want if something happens. But I do think the taboo that has existed about not talking about preparing or doing your advanced directives is becoming less so. And so these conversations are becoming more common, but honestly not common enough. I don't think we've reached the topic of advanced care planning being so popular that we don't have to have programs like this and continuous efforts at letting people know, encouraging them, and getting the job done.
Yeah. I got to believe it's difficult. I know it's such a difficult topic. I've had to go through it myself with some family members and helping them, and it actually went pretty well. But how do you encourage patients to talk about death and serious illness? I mean, they're hard topics.
Ben, I'm going to step in here, but I hope that you'll also add some things. For one thing, we need to try to normalize it. That's partly what this advanced care partnership is in our Fox Valley region, is an effort to help normalize those conversations so that they're not so uncomfortable. But in the family physician's law office or an internist or a specialist office, it's best if we try to regularize it by, when you're having an annual preventive exam. I know that my MAs take a look at the electronic medical record, and if it's indicated that somebody doesn't have advanced directive, they get it out and they put it right in front of me so I can't miss it, and they tee up the conversation with that person. And I do want to add that when I appreciated that you said you had to deal with that and hinted that it wasn't all that difficult. And I find that when we open ourselves up to ask those questions of our patients, sometimes it's just refreshing that they're able to answer, I have thought about it. I think this. And it's on us as doctors and healthcare teams to continuously ask.
Yeah. Ben?
Larry, I'd like to also highlight the fact that I think on your website today or your show's page, you've got some really good resources for people in the state of Wisconsin where they can take advantage of local support from health systems and community groups. You also have a link, I think, to the State Bar's free download of the healthcare planning guide called A Gift to Your Family. That's open now, and it goes till April 25th. So I hope people will go online, take a look at those resources, and take some definitive action to move forward with this.
Yeah, absolutely. And folks can just go to WPR.org/Larry, and you go to today's date, and under the comments section, you'll find those links, which are wonderful publications. I've looked at them, and they're supply a lot of great information. Maybe we could talk about the different types of advanced directives. There are some different ways to look at it, I guess.
Yeah, I'll start with this one. There are some different ones. The most useful one, I think, is called a power of attorney for healthcare, which is a legal document where I can name an agent and an alternate agent or another alternate agent to step in for me if I become incapacitated. For people who have someone that they can appoint as their future decision maker when that time comes, that's the best alternative. For people who don't have that, there's an advanced directive called a declaration to physicians, which basically is a very narrowly focused legal document where I can basically tell the medical providers if I'm in these kinds of circumstances, I do or I don't want certain types of interventions to be used. So that's quite narrowly focused. Other things people can do is simply write down what their wishes are and in a way that they've got them clarified and provide those to friends and family members. That way, even if they have to go through a court-provided guardianship, once the guardian is finally appointed after great delay and expense and difficulty, the guardian at least has guidance for what types of decisions could be made.
Yeah, yeah. And everybody, basically, we should all have an advance directive regardless of our age, correct?
That's right. I, as an elder law attorney, I also did planning for many clients who were in their 20s with their first three-month-old child, and it was critical for those clients to understand that they also needed advance directives in case something happened to one of them.
And I'd like to add that sometimes we think about advance directives in the context of either ourselves or a loved one being elderly and or sicker and having chronic conditions or that can suddenly change or can slowly get worse and affect your longevity and your ability to live. But some of the most critical decisions that have ever been made by our courts and Supreme Court that have defined our right to complete these kinds of directives have been in the setting of young people suddenly in situations where they're unconscious in a coma, prolonged period of time, you know, with feeding tubes because people didn't know what they wanted because they didn't have an advance directive. Yeah. So at any age.
And I think parents, you know, I've got a daughter who's 21 years old and she's, you know, and finishing up her bachelor's degree this year. But I could not make health care decisions for her, could I?
That's right, Larry. And not only that, if she were in the hospital because something happened to her and you call that hospital to find out if she's there, they can't even tell you she's there unless you have a health care directive that she has signed authorizing you. And that's something that most parents don't understand clearly enough.
And I think the other assumption that you mentioned in passing, Ben, I believe that you can't just make health decisions for your spouse.
That's correct. Not in Wisconsin. And again, this isn't just about withholding medical care and end of life choices. This is about having an agent who can advocate for what your values are, what your preferences are, authorize things that you do want, in addition to at appropriate times, maybe making end-of-life decisions.
Talking today with a couple of guests, Dr. Lee Vogel, Executive Director of Mosaic Family Health, Ben Adams, Emeritus Director of the Board of Directors of the Wisconsin Chapter of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, both founding members of the Fox Valley Advanced Care Planning Partnership. Great to have them with us. And you can join in as well. I see we have a nice email. We'll get to that. You can email us, too. The number's talk@WPR.org. Or you can phone us with your own experiences or questions. The number 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have Dr. Lee Vogel and Attorney Ben Adams with us today on the show as we talk advanced care planning. And again, you can join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Wayne in Oshkosh emailed us. Wayne says, Lee and Ben, it's great to hear that the two of you are still promoting advanced care planning. His wife passed away last month while she was obviously fading and not going to recover. The hospital physician came to me and proposed tube feeding, which he stated which almost certainly would become long-term. He and his wife both had well-developed advanced care plans, and his wife's choices were clear. No long-term food feeding through a tube. Given all the other decisions associated with his wife's death, her end-of-life decision making made it easy for him. So he says, congratulations on the continued success of Fox Valley Advanced Care Planning Partnership. Good to hear. Thank you, Wayne, for calling. And maybe we should take a minute to talk about Fox Valley Advanced Care Planning Partnership. How do you approach this? And maybe I could start with Ben and then go to Lee, Dr. Lee.
Sure. This is actually our 25th year, Larry, of working on the issues of advanced care planning in the Fox Valley, which we're happy to be able to comment about. We have involvement from a lot of community volunteers from local health systems over these years. I think this week we have probably 15 or 18 community events in churches, in health systems, in senior centers, at people's family holiday dinners, like Lee was talking about, where folks are talking about the need to get this thing, get it done, get it written up and signed legally so that these decisions can be made.
Dr. Lee, go ahead.
Yeah, do you mind if I'm still thinking about Wayne, and I'm grateful that you and your wife had these documents and that they guided decisions for her in such a capable way. I'm honestly surprised about the tube feeding because that used to be something that was routinely relied upon back in the 80s and has fallen out of favor because it's not particularly helpful to people in terms of even prolonging their life, but certainly their comfort. So I'm glad it ended as it did. But it's these kinds of conversations that are encouraged by this longstanding coalition that we have here. And we have managed to ensure that we've got long-term care community interested, our hospitals interested in supporting our work, and we support the work of all of the various places that somebody might encounter the need to make an advance directive.
Yeah. Joni in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Joni.
Hi. I just want to point out that for same-sex couples, it's really extremely important for them to do their advance directives. It cannot be assumed that if a partner or a spouse in a same-sex couple is ill or in the hospital dying even, that they would be allowed to visit, much less make decisions or even have information. So very important that same-sex couples are encouraged and urged to complete their advance directives.
Joni, thank you for calling. Comment, Dr. Lee?
Oh, that's it is a great point. Actually, any couple, and as we started the program with Ben letting everybody know that we're not a state where married couples or family members can even make the decision, but it can become even more difficult if you are a couple and you're same-sex or even, opposite-sex couples. If there isn't a marital tie or a family tie, people are less likely to listen to your voice as you speak for the person you love.
Yeah. Joni, thank you very much for calling. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Let's talk about choosing your health care power of attorney. What kind of person is typically the best fit for that?
Larry, this is Ben. Let me jump in quick. I'd like to also thank Joni for her call and pointing out that that issue, which is very important. Something else people might not understand is that if you're married and you and your spouse have done advance directive documents, but then you get divorced or your marriage is annulled, that document is canceled. And it's canceled completely by the divorce. It's not just the appointment of your spouse who's canceled. So anybody who did this while they were married and since got divorced, they need to redo this, even if they want their former spouse to continue to be their agent, which some of my clients did want that at some point. And I think the type of agent, to answer that question, that people are looking for is somebody who is going to listen to what the medical providers are wanting to recommend, but who's going to have had conversations over time with you and is going to be an advocate for your position, for what you would say yes to and what you would say no to, and is not simply going to decide things for themselves or agree with everything the doctor wants to do. Sorry about that, Lee.
No, that's okay. I'm fine with that. We need a little humility, we doctors. I think that the other thing I would add is that it's really important, like Ben said, to have the conversations with that decision maker that you chose so that they do understand, but also to ask that decision maker, well, you know, we've got a lot of discord in our family. Everybody's got an opinion. And how do you feel about standing up to, you know, your brother, your sister, or whoever, to really speak for me, to say that you know what I want. And when it going gets tough and you're worried about letting me go, but you know that's my decision, or you may have a completely different opinion about continuing, but I want something. And I've advised you of that. You've got to be able to have somebody who will feel comfortable in doing that, honoring your wishes, trying to decide and be helpful when your wishes aren't clearly known, but they have to make a decision for you, and communicating with the rest of the family members who might weigh in a way that empowers what you've decided.
Yeah. But that communication, I think, is really important. But it's still, you still need to have the written document, do you not?
That's crucial. That's crucial too. Absolutely.
So speaking about that, it doesn't do you any good to do your document and throw it in a drawer at home. It really has to be delivered to your family physician or your specialist office or the hospital so that they can review it and then scan it in to your electronic medical record. So it's accessible at the time that you would need it.
Someone's wondering, how long does it take to fill out an advance directive?
It can depend on the directive document you're using and your level of understanding and whether or not you need to go to other resources like your family physician or a specialist to get opinions about certain treatments. So I've done them in 20 minutes with clients. And Larry, the document on your website, which is called Wisconsin Advanced Care Planning Community Collaborative Advanced Directive Information, that has links in it direct to the advanced care planning resources at organizations and healthcare systems throughout the state. And people can get not only the document, but assistance, free assistance in most cases, to complete these documents in the appropriate way. I've also had clients take an hour and a half or 2 hours or longer to really work through this and get these things in the right shape for them to sign them.
So why would it take 2 hours? I mean, what would be an example of a reason?
A lot of times people get to a section of the document and they're not sure what their answer should be. They're not quite sure where their values or where the medical language in the document is coming from. So they need to perhaps do a little investigation and then come back to the topic. We had a program on Sunday at our church to talk about this with church members. And one of the people who came in had a folder and she had 7 blank advanced care directives in her folder that she'd been given 7 different times by her family physician as she went in for appointments over many years, and she never had even filled it out. So, but I'm happy to say she was able to finally complete it and get it witnessed on Sunday.
Joan called, couldn't stay with us. Her grandson is autistic and nonverbal. His mother has all the caretaking responsibilities covered for him, but what happens to him and his caretaking decisions if his mother's in the hospital and unable to make his healthcare decisions?
Right. That's a really difficult situation. If there's another parent, then the other parent would have, assuming this child is under 18, if the child is an adult and the child has the capability to, the legal capacity to sign his own directive, appointing his mother and then appointing an alternate agent, that would be the best way to handle it. If the child involved is not capable of doing that, then the parent or parents are probably already the legal guardians through the courts for that person. and in that case, possibly a successor guardianship would need to be set up through the courts and for somebody to step in. This is not something that you can simply delegate for another person. I can pick my own agent and my own alternate agents, but my agent cannot step aside and pick another new agent for me unless I've put it in my document myself. So it's a very complicated situation that, mm-hmm. that she's outlining there.
Yeah. And I had another question. Oh, some of the questions, and here's an email. So what are some of the questions on the form?
The questions on the form have to do with, first, who is your agent and who are the alternate agents and what is their contact information? And then one of the questions that people sometimes get stumped by is, if I need to be in a long-term care facility like a nursing home for extended care, do I authorize my agent to admit me or do I say no to that? Because I may not really want to go to a nursing home for extended care. And if I say no, then I'm still going to have to go. It's just that I have to go through the court system after having a guardianship, which is a lot of difficulty and a lot of expense.
Yeah, a lot of difficulty and a lot of expense. And I would also just throw in a will is extremely important as well.
That's part of complete, overall estate planning, a will and a financial power of attorney. Larry, staying on the medical side, I want to point out another thing. One of the questions in most advanced directive is, if a woman is pregnant at the time that the directive has to be put in place, does she want her agent to be able to make decisions for her? And the trouble with these documents is they're all written in language, and the language isn't always as clear as it should be. If somebody could become pregnant, they're very wise to do a directive and say that I do want my agent to be able to make medical decisions for me, even if I'm pregnant, because if they don't say yes, the document is canceled by the pregnancy. And even though they may have done a directive, the fact that they didn't say they want their agent to make medical decisions during pregnancy will effectively negate the document entirely. So it's not just pregnancy decisions, it's all medical decisions that will not be able to be made by that appointed agent.
Hmm. Listener emailed us their sweetheart, age 82, and this listener is 75, travel often, both domestic and international. They aren't married, nor do they live together. What would you recommend that they do in preparation for these trips and the potential for needing to be the decision maker for each other when they're not in their hometown?
Well, I'm going to step in because as a physician, you know, it's very difficult if you're caring for somebody, particularly if it's in the emergency room, it's an acute hospital situation, it's in a clinic, and you realize that somebody needs to have decisions made because something has happened and they can't contribute to the decision making. And if they're traveling from somewhere else, you're stuck trying to find out if there's an electronic medical record that's accessible from a distance. And that's more complicated when you're out of state and when you're out of country. First and foremost, complete the documents, have the conversation between each other and then the agents, if that is the other person, certainly. But anybody who's listed as an agent, first or second. And then I recommend that you make copies of that and you carry it with you. It's probably a good idea to have it in your suitcase as well as in your travel bag. If you're in a car, that you have it in a glove compartment. I just, you know, none of us are doing it to that degree or as thoughtfully as we might each and every time, but I don't think you can be too compulsive if you're, you know, really traveling a lot or world traveler, and you're also certainly have any medical illnesses.
Yeah, and if in that case, if the two people may have somebody else listed as the first person, but they might have themselves listed as the second person.
Yeah, Larry, that's a, you know, for older unmarried, well, for any unmarried couple, they have to decide, or a second marriage, you have to decide, who do I want to appoint as my primary agent? Is it my best friend, my partner, so to speak, or is it my adult child? You know, that's the challenge. And each person, we all each have to make our own choices there. And I echo Lee's advice about getting copies of these things where they need to be. The other way is I have a copy on my cell phone, and I also have on my cell phone access to the MyChart electronic medical record, so that a lot of medical systems around the country could access, with my permission, could access my records. So that's another way to keep those documents and that information accessible as you travel.
And just one more on the travel part of it. If in this situation that we had a couple not married and may have different first or primary, if they're in another country, even though that person was second on the list, would that person in that situation be allowed to serve in that capacity?
If I guess let me answer that in two ways. It sounded like, as you read the question, that they were thinking, or at least the person who was asking the question was saying they were going to name each other as the primary decision makers. And if they did that, then the primary decision maker is going to be along on the trip. But the other part of your question is, if the medical system provider, if Lee Vogel can't reach to communicate with the primary decision maker, she has every right to go to the next decision maker and try to get the answer there.
That makes sense. UW Extension offers a program relevant to this conversation. It's called Planning Ahead. It's a 7-session research-based program that will help participants understand how to prepare for the end of life for themselves or a loved one, and understand the importance of having a plan in place. Planning Ahead, it's called. Ahead.
That's a great program, Larry. We've our extension up here in this part of the state has offered that numerous times over many years. I've been a resource person on the legal questions and the advanced directive questions, as have some of my colleagues from the law firm. It's a super program, and I encourage people to look into it.
Yeah, I want to add that, you know, we've hosted those at Mosaic Family Health as well. And my observation from having some of my own patients participate is that it really is an excellent opportunity that's enhanced if you take somebody with you. So if you are a couple or two sisters or, you know, a daughter and son along with a parent, that just people are doing this together, and it causes you to think about things, to act on them, to get both your financial and your healthcare documents done, completed, thought about, reach out and do whatever you need to do legally. But it also just spurs all sorts of conversations that ripple out beyond those people.
Yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. Someone else wondered about revoking the power of attorney. How and when could that happen?
You can revoke it in a number of ways, Larry. One is by doing a new one. If I sign a new one today, the one I signed yesterday is invalid, as long as the new one is valid. You can revoke it by verbally saying, I no longer want this to be in effect. You can revoke it in writing. If somebody does decide to revoke their power of attorney, I always recommend it to those clients that they notify everybody who either had a copy of the old document or was one of the old agents, to let them know that they're no longer in authority. Because I had seen real problems arise when, you know, there were more than one person who thought they were the current agent and wanted to come in and make decisions and didn't realize they were either that they had been fired, so to speak, by the revocation of the document.
Oh, my gosh. When, and someone else, when do these advanced directives go into effect?
Yeah, that's a really good point, too. Lee, do you want to do that?
Yeah, it really, I think sometimes people fear that once they've made it and they've named a decision maker or two decision makers, that somehow they've given away their right to speak for themselves. And really, it requires the assessment of two physicians or a physician and a psychologist or a physician and an advanced practitioner, such as a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant, to evaluate one's cognitive ability to make decisions and determine that you lack decision-making capacity. And you know, what that really means is in order to have decision-making capacity, you have to be able to hear the information or read information if you couldn't hear, but it was presented to you in some fashion. And then you have to be able to think about, you know, the various options facing you and in a health decision, and to weigh the pluses and the minuses and to weigh them against your own value system and experiences, and then be able to communicate a decision back. And so we take the time to thoughtfully evaluate somebody's ability to make decisions before we would fill out a form that has a declaration of incapacity. And oftentimes, mostly we're dealing with persons who have developed a dementia or some other condition that's affecting their ability to think.
Yeah. Well, you guys are doing wonderful work here, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. And a reminder, if you want the links, as you listen, you want the links to the Wisconsin Bar Association's A Gift to Your Family, Healthcare Decision Planning Guide, and the updated 2025 Advanced Care Planning Contacts Wisconsin document. This resource provides health system and local ACP contacts throughout Wisconsin. You can go to our page today, the Larry Mehler Show. So WPR.org/Larry. And go to today's date, and you'll find those available to you to copy and or click on and take a look at. And if you want to, then you can make a copy of them right off your own printer at home. Lee, Ben, thank you both so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it, and I hope we have a chance to do this again down the road.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
Yeah, so grateful you invite us. Thank you.
Dr. Lee Vogel, Executive Director of Mosaic Family Health. One of our guests, the other, Ben Adams, attorney and Emeritus Director of the Board of Directors of the Wisconsin Chapter of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to debt collections, lawsuits, and bankruptcy. That next. I'm Larry Mehler for WPR News. Thanks so much for listening in today on WPR News. Larry Mehler here. We're going to talk about debt for a bit with you. Debt can be a tool. Hey, I'm in debt. I've got a... I'm paying off my home, or trying to anyway. Buying a home certainly is one way we go in debt. Getting an education, that's another way. Maybe starting a business. It can be hard to manage, and there are some pretty serious consequences if you can't keep up with the bills. And we're talking about debt collection. We'll talk lawsuits and bankruptcy and a couple of guests for you. Josh Christensen here with us. He's an attorney who helps clients with bankruptcy, debt relief, and debt collection services. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, great to have you here. And Amanda Kosman back with us. Amanda is a family living educator with UW Extension's Human Development and Relationships Institute. Amanda coordinates and teaches financial capability programs in Walworth County. And Amanda, thank you for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me on the show again.
Well, as we talk with our two experts, I hope you'll join in. Let us know your questions about handling debt, or maybe you have questions about filing for bankruptcy. I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Amanda, most of us have some kind of a debt at one point or another in our lives, and often ongoing. It could be a mortgage, it could be a student loan, it could be a credit card. But when does debt become a problem?
Debt becomes a problem when people can't pay those things back and live the life that they really want to be able to live. When debt gets in the way and it's causing emotional stress for the individual, relationship stresses for them, when that debt is getting to the point where they financially can't live the life they want to, is really the biggest one when people start worrying about it the most and come to us. But there are those early warning signs of relationship issues, sleeplessness, and worrying that really compound and take away from people's quality of life.
Yeah. And people sometimes miss payments. Maybe they intend to hit the next due date, for example. What happens when you miss a payment or two?
Well, most people think through the process and they think, oh, I'm going to get a fee. Because, of course, the late payment fee is something that occurs quite often. But many times also that can reduce the credit score if it goes beyond a certain point. So I always tell my clients is to make that payment as soon as possible. And be very proactive. If you're going to miss one and you know you can't make it, call sooner. See if you can get that deadline extended or come up with a payment plan before it hits your credit report. So it can long-term affect you if it's something that's consistent, depending on your financial history. But also, it causes stress for people if you're thinking about it a lot before that payment is coming up. That might be the big red flag that you need to jump on this as early as possible.
And that credit score is pretty important.
Yes, it can be super important for most things. Most people need a good credit score.
I checked mine this morning before the show just to see where I was, and I was happy to note it was 829. So I'm in pretty good shape when it comes to if I needed another loan or something. Josh, could you walk us through what happens during a basic consumer collection lawsuit? How are you notified that you're being sued or by a debt collector or a creditor? That sort of thing.
Yes, certainly. So the first thing that happens is most people will end up get these advertising letters in the mail. My firm's one of them that sends these advertising letters out to everybody who's been served. The filing of a lawsuit is a public record in Wisconsin, so anybody, you know, including our law firm, can see who's been sued. So a lot of times it turns out that this is the first time that a person is notified that they've been sued to get this advertising letter in the mail. From there, it really depends on this, whether this is a large claim suit or a small claim suit. A small claim suit is the most common type of debt collection lawsuit. In that type of a suit, usually a person is served by mail, get a copy of the summons complaint in the mail, and that gives them an opportunity to go back to court and assert any defenses that they have. If it's a large claim suit, they'll probably be served in person. It could be a process server, a private process server, could be a sheriff's deputy. But the important part is that this isn't a criminal action. The sheriff's deputy's not there to arrest the person or bring them to court that day. The sheriff's deputy or the private process server just signs a piece of paper that they handed the person the lawsuit, and that establishes the court's jurisdiction over the person.
Okay. So what sorts of laws do debt collectors have to follow when they're contacting you about the debt?
Well, the big one nationally is called the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And in Wisconsin, we have the Wisconsin Consumer Act, which has a lot of the same protections. Among other things, a debt collector can't threaten you with a right that they don't have. So they can't say that we're going to have somebody on your street and we're going to arrest you unless you make a payment immediately. They can't contact third parties about the debt. They can't call up a sister or a brother or a neighbor and say, hey, would you get so-and-so to make us a payment? They can't continue to collect or to continue to communicate with a person after that person's demand not be contacted. So that doesn't prevent the debt collector from suing or going through other legal process. But in some cases, you can assert your rights under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act not to be contacted, and that'll at least stop phone calls and letters.
Yeah. Well, how do you respond, or how should you respond when you're notified?
Yeah, so the law says that a verbal notification is adequate to invoke the protections under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, but I always advise following it up with a writing. You get the address and the name of the debt collector that's calling you. You can assert the rights over the phone, but then write a letter, keep a copy of the letter for yourself, because if you're going to contact an attorney like me afterwards, that makes it a lot easier to prove what it is that you said, who you said it to, when you said it. And then if you, the debt collector violates the Debt Collection Practices Act or the Wisconsin Consumer Act, makes it a lot easier to get damages.
So what happens if, Lee Rayburn is our technical director today. What if Lee says, oh, I got this notice. I think I'll just ignore it.
Yeah, it really.
What's going to happen to Lee? He's laughing right now. I'm seeing him through the screen here.
Sure. I guess it really depends on what the notice is and the collector and how collectible the person is. I've listened to some of your other debt collection or consumer protection issues, and there are definitely people out there that we call judgment proof, that a creditor can sue them, they can get a judgment against them, but there's really nothing that the collector can do to force payment after that, like wage garnishment. Social Security cannot be garnished for regular debts. So for a person that's retired, doesn't have assets that could be taken, doesn't have wages that could be protected, sometimes ignoring it is the best course of action. For other people that have wages to protect, or even that just want the peace of mind, the mental toll that Amanda mentioned, sometimes filing for relief or getting debt relief help is advisable.
Yeah, I would think, I mean, if I was in that situation, the first thing I'd do is call an attorney. I mean, what? Amanda, you're nodding your head in agreement on that one, too. What is it? I would think an attorney could help you in a lot of ways, even emotionally.
Yeah, what I always suggest, if you are under some legal issues, that you should definitely contact an attorney to find out what your rights are. I try to work with my clients before they get there so they never see an attorney. So that's really my point. And when people start to talk to me, is sometimes they show up with that notice and we kind of walk through the process of contacting that creditor, seeing if they can do it. But really, I like to see people as a financial coach before they actually get to that point. And ideally, I would love to see everybody when they start feeling that emotional stress about their debt, before they miss those payments or when they anticipate it. So we can come up with a plan before that, so they never actually get to that attorney phase, and work out a plan and try to come up with how they can work through those debts before they become something that needs to go into the legal ramifications. But we also know that that isn't always possible. So as a financial coach, I am not an attorney. So I would always refer people to those who are, if they need that special sort of advice.
That sounds like good advice to me. We're talking with Amanda Kosman, family living educator with UW Extension's Human Development and Relationships Institute, and with attorney Josh Christensen. He helps clients with bankruptcy, debt relief, and debt collection services. And we have lots more to talk about in this area. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions and comments as we move along. I'm Larry Mehler for WPR News. taking a look at debt collections lawsuits and bankruptcy on the show right now and how to handle it all with our two guests. Josh Christensen, one of them, he's an attorney who helps clients with bankruptcy, debt relief, and debt collection services. Our other guest, Amanda Kostman, is a family living educator with UW Extension's Human Development and Relationships Institute. Amanda coordinates and teaches financial capability programs in Walworth County. You can join in. Tell us your strategy for managing your debt. Other questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And let's take a couple of questions. Greg and Plover, we'll go to you first. Hi, Greg.
Good morning, Larry. I've got a question regarding a Form 1099 I received this spring in the mail indicating that a debt was written off and not paid. I don't know anything about it. I called the firm that sent the form. They have a number, an identification number on the 1099 for the account. They don't have any record of it. They referred me to a law firm they work with out of Milwaukee, and they told me there's no such thing. So I can't get any answers. Any advice?
Josh?
Sure thing. My first thought would be to talk to your tax professional about a Form 982. I'm not qualified to provide tax advice. The IRS has some pretty specific guidelines on who can do that. But my understanding is there's a Form 982 that a person can file in response to a 1099-C for cancellation of debt income, and that may remove any liability that you have there. The other thought I had is that a 1099-C is, again, my understanding is just a notification that the taxable event may have occurred. It's a notification that a creditor sends to the IRS. Doesn't mean that a taxable event has occurred. Doesn't mean that you're ultimately going to be liable for it. So definitely something to talk with your tax professional about.
All right. Greg, thank you for calling. Let's turn to Ann in Marshfield. Hi, Ann.
Hello, Larry and guests Amanda and Josh. I am fortunate that I can pay my day-to-day expenses without using credit. Thank God. But what I'm wondering is if, since I don't use my credit cards very often, is that hurting my credit score? I do use my bank cards.
Cash cards, in other words, Anne, you're saying.
Yeah, the debit cards.
Yeah, the debit cards. Okay, Amanda, you want to take a crack?
Yes, actually that can affect your credit negatively. So one of the things is, first I would wonder is, are you planning to make any purchases that you need good credit? So that's one of the things. And I want to commend you for having some really great financial principles that you're putting in place. And then also, what your financial goals are in the future are going to play into this. One of the things I suggest, though, if you're worried about your credit score going down, is to maybe use those for small things like gas, for example, because we all know that part of your credit score is that revolving credit. So it's important to use that. Your credit score and your credit report are not about how well you manage your finances. It's all about how well do you use your credit. So you have to use your credit to show them that you're good at it. So you might want to think about putting your gas for the month on there and then paying it off at the end of the month. The balance that's reported to the credit agencies is the balance at the time of the statement. So if you pay it off every month, that's okay. That's going to be really good for your credit. So you can keep doing that. I've heard some myths out there about not paying it off or leaving $5 or those kind of things. So those are just myths. I also am going to encourage you to keep it under 20% of that credit card. So if it's $1,000, you got to keep it under that 20% line to keep your credit normal. Lower the better to help keep that in there. So yes, you do have to use your credit to prove that you're credit worthy because they want to look at that and do that. But err on the side of keeping it really low to that 20%, using it consistently. And I always say those small purchases like gas, or if you have subscriptions to like Netflix and stuff, put those on the credit card because you got some certain protections that come with that credit card too. and then paying it off each month so that you are showing you're using it responsibly.
That makes sense. Now, in my own case, maybe this is stupid, but most days I'll remember and take a quick look. If I've got something charged up for the day, I pay it off right then online.
I do a lot of the similar things. Now, everybody's situation's a little different. So if you have a balance and you're paying it down, that might be sufficient, Larry, and you can pay it off every single time. And it sounds like your credit score is really good, so that's working out really good for you. But for some people, have to be more intentional. If you don't need to use that credit, it happened to my dad. And actually, his insurance came up after he paid off his house. He had a zero, like a goose egg of a credit score after so many years, because he paid off his house. He didn't have a loan on his vehicle. He didn't use his credit cards, none of that stuff. And his insurance rates actually went up. We called them. They brought them back down for him. And we started getting him the credit worthiness that he wanted to be able to get those good things. So it sounds like, Larry, it's working great for you. So if that's a principle that's working, I always encourage people to stick with the ones that they're used to that are working really good. If our caller is concerned about her credit score, if she knows it's going down, that's just some of those principles of making those small purchases and showing that she can use credit responsibly, consistently. That's really important.
Ann, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call, and use those cards a little bit. Appreciate your call very much. I wanted to get into bankruptcy, and Kyle in Winneconne has a question relating to it, so I think that might get us right into the whole discussion about bankruptcy. Kyle, what's on your mind?
Hey, thank you for taking my call, Larry and guests. I have a friend, and they recently bought a new property for rental, and they put a lot of the work done on credit cards, and probably around $50,000. And the tenant that they got in ended up not paying for quite some time. So now they have all this credit card debt to pay, and they're behind. I was wondering if bankruptcy would be a reasonable option.
Chris, do you want to – or Josh, excuse me. Josh, do you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, certainly. I'd certainly recommend that they look into it. Whether or not it's going to be right for them in their situation, there's going to be a lot of moving parts that go into that calculation. Mm-hmm. But $50,000 in credit cards is pretty substantial and going to be more than a lot of people can pay back in a reasonable amount of time. The important parts, when they contact an attorney, just be upfront and honest about everything involved in the case, because that rental property is going to count as an asset in the bankruptcy, regardless of what type of bankruptcy it is that they file. And the attorney is also going to want to know the details about taking out the debt, what it was used for.
But Kyle, there you go. It's worth looking at. So what is personal bankruptcy? I mean, what does it technically mean?
Yeah, sure thing. So the filing of the bankruptcy, probably 75% of the cases are Chapter 7 cases. The Chapter 7, technically a liquidation because there's a trustee appointed to liquidate all a person's assets. Most of the Chapter 7 bankruptcy cases that an individual will file, there's nothing for the trustee to liquidate. Their property is entirely protected by exemptions. Exemptions is just a law that allows a person to protect certain property from creditors. So there's an exemption to protect equity in a homestead, $75,000 in equity in a homestead for a person, $150,000 for a married couple. There's an exemption that can protect goods and clothes, consumer goods, $12,000 person, equity in motor vehicle, $4,000, plus any part of the $12,000 that you don't use to protect your other stuff. And so for most people, their property doesn't exceed these exemption limits. The bankruptcy takes about 3 to 5 months. You get a discharge at the end of it. The discharge makes it so the creditors can never collect on those debts ever again.
And there was a story that somebody told me that once you go through it all, your credit becomes good again because you don't owe anything.
Certainly possible. I always say, though, that I can't advise which way the credit's going to go. The Fair Isaac Corporation doesn't tell us how they calculate that for sure. But I have heard that once those creditors are reported as $0 amounts, that a score goes up.
Randy and Ripon, your turn. Hi, Randy.
Hi. I'm 68 years old, and I'm still working part-time, but I'm falling behind. I'm 2 months behind on my house payment, my credit card payment, which I had used to pay for medical bills from a heart attack several years ago. And I'm wondering if I should, I hate to do it, but if I should declare bankruptcy. But I talked to lawyers and they want $2,000. And if I had $2,000, I'd pay my bills. So I don't know what to do.
All right. Well, Josh.
Yeah, unfortunately, that number sounds about right. And I don't know that I can say that there's attorneys that charge less. Another thought, though, I think you said Ripon. The Ripon area is covered by the legal aid of Wisconsin, and the northern half of the state is covered by Judicare. These are legal service organizations. They evaluate a person based upon need, and then if the person qualifies, Judicare will pay legal fees in a civil case like a bankruptcy. We take several Judicare cases a month. And it's certainly possible, 68 years old, working part-time, that you might qualify under those income and asset guidelines that Legal Aid of Wisconsin has. So they'd probably be worth a call to see if they can pay attorney's fees.
Yeah. Mark in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hey, I wanted to make a comment, a couple things on I forgot her name, but one of your guests is speaking.
Amanda.
So I use my credit card for everything. I mean, even if it's a dollar, at the end of the month, I pay everything off. So, and basically it's thousands of dollars, and it's basically an interest-free loan for at least a month. And the other thing about the protection is, and like I said, I use it for everything I can. And we were doing a home improvement project, and we put $20,000 down on the credit card. A couple months in, this guy went out of business, and we weren't the only ones. We looked up on CCAP, and lots of people around Madison were suing this guy. Of course, they're not going to get nothing out of him. We just turned it into our credit card company, and we got paid back. The credit card company paid us back because it was services that weren't performed. So that's where that protection is great for. Otherwise, we would have been $20,000 in the hole, and since that guy didn't have any money, we wouldn't have had any recourse.
Yeah, Amanda, you're smiling a little bit on that.
Yep, those are those protections I talk about. When you're always doing those home improvement projects and stuff, that is great advice. Just those general good financial principles is there's some protections on credit cards that are super important. I always talk about travel's another one that sometimes those credit cards have protections for you if something happens in another country. When you're looking at credit cards, it's important to look at your lifestyle. What are those perks and protections you can receive by using those credit cards versus your debit cards? Because a debit card typically doesn't report, so they don't really help your credit score. So you want to make sure beyond credit, there's other reasons to use that credit card as well. Thank you so much for pointing that out.
Thanks so much, Mark. Amanda, if you're juggling more than one financial commitment, what's the best way to stay on top of it? That's what you often do, I'm sure, with your clients.
Right. Everybody's situation's a little bit different, but I can tell you what people typically end up doing. So what we do is we tend to, and this is what I see, I've coached hundreds of people, and we first will list out all of the debt. So where do you owe money? Even if you're not paying on them, maybe it's your student loans are in forbearance. What is that amount that you owe? What are the interest rates that you're paying on those? What's the minimum payment that's due? And, you know, that kind of information is very relevant when we come up with a plan. It's first to get a really good picture of it. I also encourage people to think to keep on top of checking their credit report to make sure that there's no scams that come up. Right now, since COVID, you can get those once a week. So I really encourage people to go to the annualcreditreport.com and get those things and keep on top of that. But once we have a really good picture of all the things you owe, how much the interest rates are, is to really think through which ones are the most important? Of course, housing and that kind of stuff, super important. Which ones are the highest interest rates? And figure out which ones you can pay. And we usually do kind of a debt snowball or power pay kind of program, depending on how the person, their financial situation is. Everybody's is a little bit different. You know, how do we figure that out? Is the most wiggle room going to be gotten because you paid down the lowest balance? Or is it the highest interest rate that you want to balance first? And really prioritize those. One of your callers talked about how he's behind on his mortgage payment. Contacting creditors and seeing if you can make that manageable for yourself. And maybe it's extending that those payments longer. Sometimes it's about, you know, getting into some different programs that might help pay those down or hold them off for a couple of months. There are some different ways that you can, strategies you can work with your creditors and put those things in so that you can manage them. But first, the first step is, of course, knowing how much money you have, getting a budget, knowing how much money you're gonna put out. Don't make promises you can't keep. So don't tell them you're gonna put $1,000 in if you can only make $500 payments. So really getting a really good picture, thinking through what are the best steps for you as an individual, like how much extra could you put down towards something? Do you have things in savings so you can do maybe, you know, negotiate if you owe $1,000, if you promise to give them $500 today, will they discharge that? So talking to those creditors early on and getting them on board so that you can come up with a plan for yourself so that you don't have to go and talk to Josh, hopefully in the future. and really thinking through. So, I mean, getting a really good picture and then coming up with that plan that works for your lifestyle is really important.
Yeah, and I think that the human nature is I don't want to talk to that person I owe that money to. And that's just actually probably the opposite of what you ought to be thinking.
When I tell them that they're working with their creditors is make sure they're prepared. Don't take the call on the fly when you're in the grocery store because you're not prepared for that. You want to know how much money do you have? How much can you give them? How much monthly could you promise? And don't make promises you can't keep. So I always say is if you get a notice, you call them when you're prepared as soon as possible. Get prepared and call them and know before you make those promises so that you're not getting the call when you're caught off guard and you say, oh yeah, well just put it on my credit card or put it on my, you know, take it out of my bank account. And then all of a sudden you have overdraft fees. You don't want to say anything and always get that stuff in writing too. So if you get them that they talk down a certain amount before you give them that $500, make sure they send you an email that says, if you give us $500, we're going to discharge your $1,000 debt. But you want to make sure that you're thinking through it and prepared for those conversations. But having them is super important. A lot of people just want to ignore those things, like you said, Larry. They want to ignore it. They just, oh, please, I just don't even want to talk about this. But it's best to jump on it early.
Stephen in Sister Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Stephen. Oops, are you there, Steve? Oh, I guess we lost Stephen, who had a credit card question. I was amazed at I always pay my credit card off, and I was looking at a family member's credit card bill one day, and I noticed that the interest was 29.9%, and the payments were mostly interest, the monthly payments.
It's a lot more common than you think.
I got so mad I paid it off and told that person to pay me back with no interest, and that person did. And I felt good about it, and I know that person did as well. Vivian in Green Bay. Hi. What's up?
Hi. I'm at an age where I could end up in the hospital overnight or from a fall or something. My children are out of the city. One is out of state. I set up automatic monthly minimums on my credit card. So if I'm incapacitated for a period of time, the minimum payment will be made, avoiding late fees. I will, of course, pay interest on the balance, but there won't be any late fees or compounded late fees. And it's
really simple to do.
Yeah. Amanda, good idea.
That's a great idea. Actually, that's what I do. Larry, I'm like you. I tend to pay mine off almost right away. I wait till the statement date sometimes, but I do still have that set up just like you, that that minimum payment will go out before that is due. Because if I don't look at my credit or I don't look at it on my phone, I might have missed it. So I never want those late things either. So that is a great principle to make sure that just that minimum amount comes out. And that way you're covered and you never forget to go and transfer those funds over. So love that tip. Thank you.
We were talking about death earlier on the show. And if somebody dies, if you're the only holder of the bank, of your bank, then I think the, isn't it true, Josh, that the bank freezes your account?
I don't know that I can speak to that. I think it's certainly possible that a bank could do that. as to what happens on death, I can speak to that, that a person can't inherit debt, that a person can inherit property and assets. But if a person passes away while owing a creditor money, that money's not going to be required to pay by the person's heirs or children. Sometimes it can be required to be paid out of the person's estate and their and the person who passed away their assets, but others in your family don't inherit a person's debt.
And Amanda, were you going to add to that?
Yes, I was going to say Extension offers a program called Planning Ahead. It's a 7-part session, and we talk through and go through all of these little things. You always want to, when you have an account, make sure that you have set up all those paid on death or transferred upon death so that you don't run into any of these issues. And also we talk a lot about talking to your family members about what debts you have and having that in writing so that this can actually get taken over by them, any of those important things. And everybody knows whose responsibility it is, who gets paid, how to pay them, and what things you need to do. So we talk a lot about having those conversations with your families in that Planning Ahead program. So it's a lot more complicated than you think, but we go in, it's a 7-part program that we can, and it's free through your big extension.
You know, our earlier guests were talking, mentioned Planning Ahead, and were very, had had very positive experiences with people that they've worked with. And I, we'll make sure that that's up on our page today, WPR.org/Larry. Go to today's date, and we'll have more information about Extension's Ahead program, Planning Ahead. Amanda, Josh, thank you so much for being with us today. I hope we have a chance to do this again, and appreciate your help very much. Thank you both.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks. It's been great.
Amanda Kostman is a family living educator with UW Extension's Human Development and Relationships Institute. And Josh Christensen, Josh, an attorney, helps clients with bankruptcy, debt relief, and debt collection services. Coming up, we're going to take a look at food security in our state. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. We're going to turn our attention now to food security. Food security, I think it means having sufficient access to food and proper nutrition. But for many people around the world and in our state, have some significant challenges with food security. And our guest, Jackie Anderson, with us in the studio, is here to help out and give us some good information on the status of food security in our state and what we can do about it. Jackie's executive director of a group called Feeding Wisconsin. It's actually a statewide network of food banks. And as I talk with Jackie, I hope you'll join in. Tell us how you're working to stop hunger in your community, maybe. Let us know how your local food pantries are doing. Are they getting enough donations? Are they getting enough volunteers? How do you notice food insecurity affecting maybe your own family or maybe your neighbors' families? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Jackie Anderson, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us. Maybe start by telling us more about Feeding Wisconsin.
Yeah, thank you so much, Larry. So Feeding Wisconsin is called the Partner State Association for Wisconsin, which means that we provide support around advocacy and policy work for the six Feeding America food banks throughout the state. So that means we do advocacy on the state and the federal level to ensure that our neighbors, is what we call anyone who uses a food pantry and or access to a food bank, to make sure that our neighbors have policies that support access to food, to make sure that our food banks have healthy, nutritious food and the proper resources and support that they need. And then we also are strong advocates around building coalitions, because we have so many great partners in Wisconsin within the farming community, within the Ag Coalition, that it's important that we all are working and we're all rowing in the same direction to make sure that our families are fed healthy, nutritious food.
You mentioned food bank, food pantry. Is there, what's the difference between a food bank and a food pantry?
Yeah, good question. So the food bank is the warehouse of sorts. So they get funding food purchasing in large quantities. And from there, they then deliver the food out to local pantries. So most food banks have large warehouse spaces, mm-hmm. where they have access to freezers, forklifts, all the things that then they're able to then move mm-hmm. that food from the food bank to a truck, then back to the food pantries. And it's also including distributing food out to mobile pantries. So, it could be a church, it could be a small organization that they have a mobile food pantry as well. So it's not always, big, large food pantries.
Brick and mortar kind of thing.
Exactly.
How common is food insecurity in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it's about 618,000 right now are considered food insecure. So if you're looking globally, it's about 1 in 10 adults and 1 in 6 children. So unfortunately, too, we're seeing an increase in that. So right now, our food banks and pantries are increasing about 30% to 45%. They're seeing more folks who are coming to pantries. And then, unfortunately, transportation costs are also going up. So that's why it's really important right now that we do advocacy and we really talk about the importance of funding to support all this good work that's happening.
Yeah. Mary Kay in Kenosha has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mary Kay.
Yes, I'd like to talk about food insecurity and homeless entire families, okay? Mm. They're both working. Some are working two jobs. They don't have enough money for food because they got child support or else they got insurances because they've been ill. It could be anything, okay? They can't afford the rents. They can't afford the escrows because they have to live with people until they can be able to afford that. I think it's time for the employers to start helping.
Well, what do you think, Jackie?
I think it's an interesting concept. I think there are federal programs that also support those who are homeless. So SNAP, for example, is a federal program that anyone who's homeless can purchase this. And a lot of the folks who come to our food pantries actually do have jobs. So it's not like it's only homeless folks who come to the food pantries and banks. So I think the idea of having employers help support financially, I think that could potentially make some good sense.
Some employers or some companies actually do help in the broader sense, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. I mentioned this a little in the intro, but food insecure, I mean, what does it really mean?
Yeah, it means you don't know where your next meal is coming from. So that could be someone who's homeless. It could be someone who's working. It could be, one of my a story that I tell a lot is from Nix. She's a woman who lives in Baraboo who comes to the Blessed Pantry that's up there, and She had a medical surgery and it went awry. And so she's permanently disabled. So because of that, she's now considered food insecure. Hardworking woman, has two kids. And if she didn't have access to that pantry, she wouldn't be able to make ends meet. And she's quoted by saying she oftentimes has to think about the number of meals that she's having per day so that her kids actually have food. So that is one definition of food insecurity, but it's pretty vast.
And it doesn't mean that people are sloughing off.
No way.
Not at all, does it?
No way. No. No, again, oftentimes, and it's really kind of where we are as a society, because you're thinking about rent is expensive right now, groceries are really expensive, and the wages are not matching that. So wages are not going up, but we have all these other household expenses that are going up. So then it just puts us in a position where people are having to go to a food pantry. You know, even prior to COVID, they would maybe have to go once, and now they're having to go three or four times just to be able to make ends meet.
Jennifer in Madison emailed us. Her son's elementary school is represented by people speaking 15 different languages coming from all over the world. It encompasses many economic strata, but 80% of the families or more at times are food insecure. They now have a food bank on site, and they have some people who go and collect from various organizations from around the city to supplement. They said they're still missing a lot of supplies, we think about food, but there's also personal hygiene items, diapers.
Yep.
That are very hard to obtain.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's so wonderful to hear, Jennifer, that you've got a school that's supportive of the entire community and understanding that it's not just food. It is oftentimes, menstrual products or, personal hygiene products that if you are struggling financially, you don't have the means to purchase those things. So it's wonderful to hear you've got such a great community there.
Yeah, Jennifer, thanks so much. And you can join in too, by the way. You could email us like Jennifer did at talk@WPR.org or give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Just thinking about this, there's a definite link here in my mind between access to food and just living a healthy, productive, and decent life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why we really look at the importance of healthy, nutritious food. And our food banks do a wonderful job in working with their local partners and their local farmers to get as fresh produce as much as possible to the food banks, because we know that that is what people need and that is what people want. I think there's a lot of discussion out there around, people should accept anything that they are given, when we want people to have dignity and we want people to have as healthy and nutritious food as possible. They all go hand in hand.
John's wondering, what are the requirements you need to meet in order to be able to take food from a pantry?
Yeah, so there are, most recently there has been some policy changes. So you no longer have to show ID. You can go to any food pantry. So no one's going to ask what your income is. Our food pantries and our food banks are very understanding. And if you need food, go to one of your food pantries. There's no specific requirements that you need. All you need to do is to say that you need food access.
Jackie Anderson, our guest today, Executive Director of Feeding Wisconsin, and we're talking about food security in our state today. It sounded like, what is it, Jackie, 10% of our...
One in 10 adults, one in 10 children. One in 6
in
children.
In our state.
Correct.
Our food insecure. That's an enormous number. Talking with her about how it's being addressed and what our needs are, with her. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Look forward to hearing from you. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking food security today with Jackie Anderson, Executive Director of Feeding Wisconsin. Great to have her with us. And again, you can join us, 800 800- 642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Could you describe the experience of visiting a food pantry? What should you expect if you've never been there before?
Yeah. So Feeding Wisconsin, within all of our food banks, we partner with about 1,000 different food pantries. So many of them are very, very different. And I think what all of our food pantries strive to do is, again, to ensure that anyone who's coming to a food pantry is treated with respect and with dignity and hopefully given choice in what they have available for food. So a lot of our food pantries are... again, I can't focus enough on the nutritional side of the food pantry, and they're very cognizant about even how they display the food. They want it to feel like it is a grocery store and that it's welcoming. And, you know, if it needs to be in various languages, because we know, you know, we have lots of different languages within our state. So they make sure that there's our staff, let's say, who speak that the predominant language. And then it is... you know, again, it is supportive. So if someone has a disability, for example, they make sure that there are staff who can help them, whether that carry the food. And it's also, you know, there's a food pantry in La Crosse that we work really closely with. And they're so cognizant about how the food is presented and how the food is given to the neighbor that they understand that if you put produce at the bottom of a cart, for example, and you put canned goods on top of that, it's going to get smushed. And nobody likes smushed produce. So, you know, they've been really strategic in having someone actually help them carry the produce because they know that that's so important because of the nutritional value for our neighbors.
Becky in Sauk City will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Becky.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, great. So I just wanted to say I retired a few months ago, and I have been volunteering at the food pantry here in Sauk City, and I just want to encourage anyone who has, you know, a little bit of time to think about volunteering at your local food pantry. It really makes a difference. It doesn't take a lot of time. You know, can devote kind of as much or as little time as you have. You know, and there are lots of different tasks that need to be done. So, you know, manning the store, quote unquote, you know, for distribution is one. You just help people, you know, pick out what they need and, you know, help carry the groceries to their car if they need it. Then there's, you know, going to pick up distributions. Costco in Middleton donates quite a lot to our food pantry. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of, you know, once every couple weeks or once a month, however often you want to do it, you know, going down to Costco and picking up the stuff that they're donating and bringing it back to the food pantry. And then there's, you know, the sorting of all of that and the putting it on the shelves. And there's just a real wide variety of things to do. And it's really, really helpful. It's really important. And I also want to point out that, you know, just it's not a matter of, you know, some people are homeless or some people, you know, work but don't make enough money. There are lots of people who are homeless and work. So that's not an either or.
Becky did a great job of describing all the different things you could do as a volunteer.
Yeah, and I'm nodding aggressively, Becky, because so much of what you said is so true. Oftentimes, food banks will get, you know, a huge bag of rice, let's say, and all of that needs to be divided into smaller increments so that then they can go out to the food pantries. And so our volunteers are crucial in helping to do like those types of tasks. And like you said, food rescue is another really big part of our food pantries and our food banks, because we do try to rescue as much food as possible to ensure that it doesn't go into any landfills. And that's actually one of the reasons why we're advocating on behalf of transportation costs for our food banks, because if you look specifically at Second Harvest of Southern Wisconsin here in Madison, Just last year, they traveled over 198,000 miles back and forth from the food bank to the food pantries, and transportation costs are going up. So, you know, absolutely, that is so important that our volunteers are a crucial part of making all of this work. But then we also have the transportation that we need so desperately as well.
Yeah. Becky, thanks again. Janet in Iron Ridge, your turn. Hi, Janet.
Hi. My question kind of goes with the last caller on volunteering. I had considered volunteering years ago for Meals on Wheels, and that would be like through the local senior center. And I was wondering if Feeding Wisconsin has any volunteer opportunities to deliver food from a food pantry to the homebound and the elderly who can't make it into the food bank.
So if anyone volunteers through Feeding Wisconsin, what we then do is filter them out through all the food banks because we don't have a food bank ourselves. So we don't necessarily, I mean, some food pantries do home deliveries, but I think it just really varies on what is in your area that would make the most sense. But would be happy to help you figure that out if you need to.
Yeah. Janet, thank you so much. Gene in Portage called, couldn't stay with us, but is wondering how Feeding Wisconsin is funded.
Good question. So we are funded in support of our food banks. They provide a portion of our funding, and then we also have small grants. We do receive part of our because we oversee the SNAP contract. So there is some funding that we receive from that perspective, but we are always interested in donations and other potential funding to help us continue our advocacy work.
Yeah. So do you have fundraising efforts or?
We do. So we have right now a really fun fundraising piece that the Beef Council is actually doing on behalf of us, where they're selling shirts and collecting donations as well. So we've got little efforts here and there.
Pat in Milwaukee, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Pat.
Aloha, Larry. I have worked at several food pantries in the Milwaukee area, and what your guest has described is very typical of what goes on. But what I'd like to say, if you are a person in need of food, whether you have no permanent address or if you live in the area where the food pantry is located, and most food pantries in Milwaukee are done by zip code, you need to bring a photo ID and one piece of mail that has your address on. That's how you get registered. And yes, you do select your foods. In the Milwaukee area, it's not uncommon that a church food pantry in a lower income zip code or even a moderate income zip code might partner with another very wealthy church. I used to drive to Brookfield, 22 miles, to pick up food, and I would fill my entire Chevy Impala and then come back to Milwaukee and drop it off on 7th and Lincoln. And we were ever so grateful for the amount of support that we had. So that's all I need to let you know.
All right. Pat, thanks very much for calling. Jackie, a comment.
Yeah, so some of our food pantries, if they are receiving food, that's called TFAB food. So that's the Emergency Food Assistance Program. If a food pantry is receiving food from that program, you actually do not need your ID. That's a new policy change that has been implemented as of late last year. So I don't want that to be a barrier for folks who are interested in going to a pantry for food access.
And Pat, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Edie emailed us, what's the current relationship between Wisconsin farmers and food pantries?
Yeah, so like I said earlier, the food banks work very closely with their local farmers to ensure that they get food access, that fresh produce. We also work with a lot of our tribal communities to support something called the Tribal Elder Boxes. So those are local indigenous farmers. They also, we make sure that they have access and are provide Tribal Elder Boxes for folks who are 55 years old and older in the tribal communities. So that's another section of farmers that we work really closely with.
Susan in Madison, your turn. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to share an organization that deals with young girls. I live here in Madison, but I'm in Arizona. In the wintertime, I'm a snowbird, as they say. But anyway, down there, I belong to an organization that has applied for a state grant, and it provides sanitary supplies to little gals who are in upper elementary and middle school. The program is called Keeping Girls in School, because oftentimes without these supplies, the girls will just stay home during the time of their periods.
Yeah.
So I think this is an important aspect of kind of tangentially related to food pantry.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin has a program that focuses primarily on menstrual products and ensuring that, you know, any young women have access to those. Because, like you said, you know, oftentimes if a student doesn't have access to the proper products, then they're not going to go to school. And we want to make sure that they go to school and that they have all the food that they need. So that's actually, it's great to hear that you've got a grant that helps focus in on that.
Mm-hmm. And Steve emailed us, the rally this Saturday, 12 to 2, is organized to purchase food at the Madison Farmers Market and then take to the collection site for the rally at James Madison Park to donate to HFFA of Dane County, Healthy Food for All for Dane County. It's a good way to donate fresh food that can be distributed to food pantries. And this whole business about money, I mean, I'm sure you'd like people to advocate for food programs in the state budget.
Yeah. So that's primarily what we're focused on right now because we are in state budget season. Currently, Wisconsin is one of a handful of states that doesn't receive any state funding to support our food banks. So we're advocating on behalf of $30 million to go towards Wisconsin-produced food that would then go directly to food banks and our other organizations. So that is a piece where, you know, we're talking to local legislators. If any of your callers are ever interested in helping to spread the word, any conversations and stories that you can share with your local officials, with your city council folks, with your mayors, even local businesses, every action makes a difference in ensuring that our food banks and our food pantries have the funding costs to purchase food should they need to do that, transportation costs, and then we have support for our tribal elder boxes.
Must be satisfying work, probably frustrating at times, but you're helping over 600,000 people in the state.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head where it's exciting but also a little frustrating because, you know, we've got a lot ahead of us. But I think collectively, again, with our collaborations and our partners that we have who are so supportive of this work. I mean, I think your callers are a great demonstration of that, that people really want to help others. And, you know, we just have to keep plugging along and know that every day makes a difference.
And would people find more information at your site, your website?
Yep. Yeah, so you can go to feedingwi.org. We have some letter writing campaigns on the federal level that you can certainly sign on. And then there's also more information on our advocacy budget asks.
Well, I hope a lot of people do that.
Me too.
Jackie, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for spending time to be with us today. I hope we can do this again.
Oh, that'd be fun. Thank you.
It'd be a lot of fun. Jackie Anderson is our guest today. Jackie's the executive director of Feeding Wisconsin. You can go online and take a look at Feeding Wisconsin and maybe see how you can help. There's, I'm sure, plenty of ways you can help in that process. A big thanks to her, and thank you for listening and joining in for the show today. I hope we had a good show. This and all of our shows are a team effort. We have producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robin, Robbins. Our executive directors, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. And hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.